This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Welcome, everybody. Thank you for being here. It's a great pleasure to be involved in hosting this event with Aaron and to really have a space in which Sarah Nuttall and Achille Mbembe can talk about their work on Johannesburg. From their position at Wiser, Sarah and Achille have engaged a widening audience in conversations about the city of Johannesburg, in workshops, seminars, the public media, academic writing, architectural masterclasses, etc. And their work has really reinvented not only what that city is and how it is understood, but also the terms in which it engages in wider urban discourse and culture. And this is really what I want them to speak about today. The name of today's session is The Invention of Johannesburg, and it's largely attributed to their work that the city has been thought about and engaged in conversations in new ways. So I'd like to begin by asking a question. I don't know who to address this to, possibly Achille. To really speak to what is post-colonial thinking, to draw on his earlier work, and how does this permeate your work on Johannesburg?
We are very happy to be here. I was very happy to see some old friends of mine and colleagues, because as Lindsay said, I spent some time in this city, and I remember the time I spent here very, very well and nicely. The first thing, first response to your question, Lindsay, is that I do not really consider myself to be a post-colonial theory, nor do I consider the work I do as being part of that intellectual constellation. I'm very sympathetic to post-colonial theory, but I'm not a member of that fraternity or sorority, if you wish. What we try to do in the work on Johannesburg was two things. I'll present them very briefly, and Sarah is here, and she will add whatever I have missed. First of all, we wanted to distance ourselves with a set of preoccupations that have animated the study of cities in the continent. The study of cities in Africa has generally proceeded in terms of a logic of urbanization. Urbanization in the sense that the city is fundamentally a problem. It is, in fact, an intractable problem, a problem that almost can never be resolved, but we'll try to resolve it, and then we'll come up with policy recommendations as to how to turn these human entities into proper functioning cities. So we didn't want to go that route. Nor did we want to embrace African urbanism as understood, usually. Africa is understood as a sign of difference, in fact, of ineradicable difference. We also wanted to take a step back from a certain form of theorizing cities, which was very predominant at the time we were writing, and which was epitomized by the works of the likes of Saskia Sassen, Global Cities. Saskia Sassen, in her original work, identifies three or four global cities. After much criticism, she added a few others. Most of them were, by the way, Western cities, maybe with the exception or the supplement of Tokyo, which is, of course, where you know. So we didn't want to go that route. Now, positively, what is it that we wanted to do? First, we wanted to take very seriously the question of cityness. Cityness as part of a larger process of, let's say, an instantiation of what modernity is all about. Not modernization, but modernity. Modernity itself seen as, in fact, a concatenation of histories which are embedded in each other, entangled, to use a term Sarah likes to use, form of modernity which in this specific place called Johannesburg, which is a very recent city in fact, it was built in the very last years of the 19th century, emerged out of the discovery of gold, underwent a period of industrialization in a very compressed time. The temporality of industrialization in South Africa is, at least in Johannesburg, is in fact very limited in time, which suggests that it was extremely violent, but at the same time productive of all sorts of possibilities. So we wanted to take modernity as a concatenation, in the second sense in which if you land to Johannesburg today, it would be the first response of people who come there say, but this is not Africa. Where is Africa? Because they have this idea of Africa as the sign of difference. They arrive in Johannesburg. There are major highways. The airport is akin to what you can find. Where is it? In Shanghai. So they say, this is not Africa. And indeed, this is not only Africa. Some people will say, but this looks too much like Los Angeles. And indeed, it looks like Los Angeles. And when you go to the inner city, the main central part of the city, the old one, there are parts which look very European. So we wanted to capture that concatenation of forms, of histories, of densities, of contents, and we did it in a term we use in the introduction, Afropolitan. For us, the modernity of this place, we call it Afropolitan. Afropolitan suggesting a certain attitude, embrace of worldliness. Worldliness being not exactly the same as sameness, but worldliness being certainly a way in which difference is embraced, subsumed, and transcended. So we wanted really, Lindsay, to go to that core, how to account for a certain form of African modernity we call Afropolitan as evidence in a city that is like other African cities, but a bit more than other African cities. That is somewhat like European cities, but a bit more like European cities or American cities. That supplement is something that is at the heart of this project. And for me, it is quite different from, let's say, a typical post-colonial reading, which would be premised indeed on a logic of difference between homeland and a metropole and the conflict between these two entities. We didn't want to go there.
Can I say something about
Sarah,
that?
Sarah, please do.
I was just start by teasing my husband because only someone from the Francophone world would write a book called On the Post-Colony. and say that he knows nothing about and wishes to have nothing to do with post-colonial studies. And often when we travel, Achille wants to go through Paris and I want to go through London. So we carry with us our post-colonial legacies. But, you know, so inevitably my point of view is different and my answer to that question is somewhat different because I was trained to some extent, or certainly for my PhD, I was schooled in post-colonial studies in Britain. And, you know, for some time felt that that was an interesting and important lens for a place like Africa, South Africa, and then came back to Johannesburg and you know, began to feel this increasing disconnect between post-colonial studies per se and the kind of challenges of this particular location. And I think that they have to do with something about time and temporality, that living in Johannesburg, you're moving simultaneously across multiple timescapes. And so the sort of fairly staid temporalities of post-colonial studies simply didn't seem to work. I think that the investment by post-colonial studies in the notion of the margins, the notion of resistance, the notion of difference, are tremendously important and have been tremendously valuable, particularly if you are looking from the European metropole. But if you're living and working and trying to invent a place called Johannesburg, they do seem restrictive. And the politics of difference, the politics of resistance, comes to seem restrictive in certain ways. So that's just really my take on post-colonial studies and where it's not enabled us to go if we really are thinking from the south and not from the northern metropoles.
Just to add to the Frenchness thing, there's a very harsh critique of post-colonial theory in the introduction of on the post-colonial, time on the move. So it's not just a posturing.
He's quite defensive now. He's quite defensive.
I'd like you to speak a little bit more about your idea of the metropolis. And you've spoken about the
Afropolitan.
The Afropolitan in Johannesburg. But why the metropolis and why elusive?
Well, the metropolis was a word that we chose for two reasons. One, we did not want really to talk about the global city that was then belatedly extended to cities in the south because we wanted to talk about cultural economies of the city, which the global city paradigm really doesn't do in a fundamental way. So that was one form of address. But the other form of address was to people writing about South African cities. And we wanted to kind of deliberately come at a form of provincialism, which has beset the South African academy and besets most academies. But and the particular form of provincialism was a form of South African exceptionalism. And it seemed to us obvious that there were ways of talking about Johannesburg that would put us in conversation with New York or with Mumbai. And so choosing the word metropolis seemed to be a way of entering into a conversation, but also making an assertion to people working in the north, which was that it should become impossible to think about the contemporary global city, the contemporary city, without also thinking about a place like Johannesburg. So those were the kinds of moves that we wanted to make with this project.
The other one is that we wanted to take seriously the historicity of Johannesburg as such. And as you know very well, the concept of the metropolis in Western critical theory, at least, is very much linked to history of capitalism. It has some metropolis is somewhat the child of capital. Zombart, Max Weber himself, Benjamin, Krakauer, we can quote them at length. So we wanted to take seriously the fact that this city in the southern hemisphere was indeed the creation of capital. But capital, not in a homogenizing manner, because capital works in different manners, in different places, at different times. And in the case of Johannesburg, capital worked very, very closely with, let's say, the history of capitalism is absolutely associated the histories, brutal histories of race, for instance, but also to histories of creation of forms which are linked to the story, global story of the commodity. This is not something people working on cities in Africa usually take seriously. They will talk of life, human life in African cities in terms of informal economies. Of course, you do have forms of informal economies in Johannesburg, but you also have very formalized structures of capital, the way you find them in Rio de Janeiro, in Sao Paulo, or for that matter, in Mumbai or in New York. So we want to take seriously the historicity of the city and its link to histories of capital. Therefore, the use of the term metropolis to account for the life of urban forms.
Do you want to speak a little bit to the elusiveness of this metropolis? Shall we move on?
I think it was really that we wanted to say something about the gap between the way in which the city had been described until that time and the way in which things appear to us to actually be. So we wanted to work across that gap and to address the title of our presentation today, that in fact it was possible to reinvent a city if you really started to think about it in terms of somewhat different ideas. And that was the project of the book. I think so.
So the project was at this, both political, and there's a political intention behind this way of reading the city, as well as intellectual, both preoccupations arising from our location in this place that is trying to reinvent itself, which is a place yoked by a terrible history, but which is also a place of possibilities. And therefore, embedded in the book is one of the spirits of the book is to take seriously what would a politics of possibility, what would it look like when applied to this place and this urban location.
I think your work has been very influential on my own work, and I think one of the very simple and yet very profound ideas, which I picked up from your work very early on, was the idea that to write is to bring into being. To write is to form. So writing becomes a way of reimagining the world rather than simply accounting for it. And I think, you know, following that idea, there seem to be two really powerful spatial metaphors that you've used to reinvent the city through. And the first one of those is a kind of sectional metaphor, the idea of the metropole having an underneath. And I'd really like you to speak more about that. Aaron and I found a wonderful quote from the introduction to Johannesburg, the Elusive Metropolis, which talked about the underground and the underneath. And I'd really like you to speak to that idea.
You want to go for it?
No, yeah,
go
you
for
can it. Go.
We came to the concept of the underneath from two complementary, I would say, directions. So I will speak on this in a moment from her background as a literary and cultural critic, and me, I mean, believe it or not, as an historian. The city was created as a result of the discovery of gold in the Witwatersrand. The Witwatersrand is the region where Johannesburg is located. In order to extract gold, one has to dig in the soil. So, gold has been exploited in Johannesburg for, one would say, the last 90 to 100 years. So people have been digging in the soil for that amount of time. And they are still digging in the soil using all sorts of technologies. In order to dig in the soil, you need labor. Labor came from almost everywhere in the world. Came from California, from Europe, from Australia, from all parts of the world. So far so that, in fact, Johannesburg is a city built by people who, for the most part, came from somewhere else. That the city has, in terms of its demographic history, an elsewhere, or multiple elsewheres, and therefore, to use a Deleuzean notion, multiple lines of flight. But labor, the huge part of the labor, came, of course, from black South Africans, and black Africans from within the region, to the point where, if you ask me what are the boundaries of Johannesburg today, I would tell you the boundaries of Johannesburg extend from Cape Town to Lubumbashi or Kinshasa. Because those who built the wealth, they came from as far as that. I didn't even mention the Chinese. They came from China too. Or long histories of labor migration involving indentured labor from India. So if you want, that's what the city is all about. And if you look at the topography of the city, it is difficult, impossible to look at it without taking very seriously this underground, this underneath, which was simultaneously a space of wealth creation and a space of horrible exploitation of capital, exploitation of what? Of black labor, of racially circumscribed, coded bodies, many of whom died in the process. So it's someone to take seriously that paradox written in those early and even now contemporary process of wealth creation, which cannot be dissociated from histories of if you want, burial. That's to some extent, temples of capital are also huge graveyards. So, as an historian and as somebody who tries to take seriously the history of the place where I was born, that's how I come to the concept of the underneath. The notion of the underneath, referring also from a purely anthropological point of view to a whole body of African metaphysics in which reality is what we are, what we can touch, but in fact, deep reality is what we cannot see. It is in the realm of the invisible. It is in that doubleness of every given form or every given being. That's where it is located. That's where the truth is located. So I come to that concept of underneath from these two theoretical and experiential locations.
The idea of the surface and underneath has been very of great interest to me too, but from a completely different point of view. In one of William Kentridge's short films on Johannesburg, which many of you must know, the quintessential mining engineer has his morning coffee. He's sitting in his office and he has his morning coffee and he pushes down the coffee plunger, but instead of stopping at the bottom of the coffee pot, the plunger goes down through the table and then down through the floor and then into the mining stopes below to the sites of production and dispossession. And so that was in about 1990. And then if one thinks back to Nadine Gordimer's novel, The Conservationist, 1974, the quintessential mining engineer has a farm. And on that farm, a black body has been hastily buried, a murder victim, it seems. And one evening, there's a great storm from Mozambique that comes in and washes away the topsoil. And the body of the black man rises to the surface. And so it seems to me that there is a history in the cultural life of the city, a story that is told from the point of view of a surface and an underneath. And the surface is the site of repressed meaning, and the true meaning will be found in the depth explanation. So I think that we can track that through sort of literary and cultural understandings of the city. But it might also take us some way towards understanding the influence of structural Marxism in the reading of a place like Johannesburg, where, of course, the depth explanation is the explanation which has to do with production and labor, and which is what is going to get us away from shallow liberal explanations. And indeed, Marxism has dominated the history of the city for a long time. It's very interesting in that context to look at what contemporary artists are doing now with the question of the surface and the underneath. And I think of one artist in particular. Her name's Penny Siopis. And what she's doing is painting a series of surfaces which also adopts the color of skin at some point. And in one of these paintings, she inserts into the skin surface a plastic wound. And that seems to be very interesting because, of course, it reminds us of the allegorical, metaphorical status of the wound, of the great wounding, the great trauma, the repressed meaning of the apartheid symptom. But it also asks us, in figuring it as a plastic wound, to begin to take the surface, the horizontal reading, more seriously, to look across surfaces as well as down. And so we read down and we read across. And for many of us working on the history of the present in Johannesburg now, the question we're confronted with is, well, when do we read apartheid back in and when do we not? And so inevitably and again, as I'm saying, the meaning will be derived from the depth explanation of reading down into the past, but also reading across the surfaces of the present, and finding out where we are now. So I think that you'll see from both of our observations that this metaphor of the surface and the underneath is one that I think theoretically, critically brings Johannesburg alive, but can also then be used to think about other cities elsewhere. That's how we've been seeing it anyway.
May I just add something here? The way you're talking about it reminds me of the beautiful new book that Anu and Dilip have just produced on Mumbai, where they argue that India itself as an idea is inseparable from its planning, its being drawn in plans, which can only read the surface. And their work dislodges this reading through the drawing literally of sections. So one starts to, the metaphor I think has enormous richness for reading many cities on many levels. The second idea I'd really like you to talk about is the idea that from the title of your book, Sarah, Entanglements, and it's an idea that you started to use a few years ago, in fact, when I was still in Johannesburg, and it's once again a really evocative idea that starts to become very useful in achieving certain things in your work. Would you talk to that?
Yeah, well, I think that one of the things that happens through writing, as you were saying, is that you can find the words to invent a place in a completely new way. But I think that something that's been meaningful for me is that you could use writing and thinking and critical theory to make a place habitable for yourself and perhaps for your children. And Johannesburg is a brutal city. It's a difficult city. It carries with it a confrontation on a daily basis with other people's pain. The sort of agony of the social is something that you live with in an intimate way. And it's a deeply demanding place. It's a very important place if you're white and you're in a minority, even though some white people have economic power. You engage with the lives of black people in a profound way, and there is a question mark over how you live your whiteness in a very challenging way. So having said those things, I came to a point in my thinking and my understanding, and this is a reflection back again, perhaps to post-colonial studies, I came to a point where I felt that I'd reached the limits of the politics of difference to try and make a place for myself. To find, both historically and in the present, a kind of politics and history of mutuality, which was constituted by those moments of intersection and understanding and mutual intelligence where black and white South Africans saw each other. And I happen to think that 1994 would never have happened if there wasn't some potential, latent potential, some kind of political and critical subterrain that enabled us to develop some understanding of the kind of intimacy we had shared, whether it was in the context of the prison or the home, that we had some intimate knowledge of each other, which was worth something, which was not something that the political agenda of the anti-apartheid movement enabled us to speak about. So I over many years, came to this concept of entanglement, which is really saying that there is a way in which we are entangled across the lines of race and class, and to some extent gender and generation, which is part of the work of actively trying to find a future. And this is a language which is not the language of liberalism. I share a deep critique of that kind of discredited ideology. But it strikes me powerfully, too, how after 15 years of African nationalism, of nationalism, nationalism has profoundly failed in trying to offer us any kind of language of mutuality. And so it is that we might want to plumb the resources of other kinds of ideologies to try to think about that. So entanglement occurred to me as a self-demanding language which enabled us to begin the work of exiting the politics of difference, which I think has been profoundly useful and important for post-colonial studies. But if you're trying to build a society, find a future for yourself and make a place habitable so that you can live there and dream there about something, it seems to me that you have to work at the limits of the rigors of that particular kind of politics and make other demands of yourself. So that is what I wanted to do. I wanted to get at the ugly side of entanglement. It's not meant to be a happy concept. It's meant to be a complex concept. And I think post-colonial studies produces a set of subjects in the post-colony who carry with them the shadows of victimage and to whom we then accord the right to be resistant and the right to have rights. What we don't accord to them, it seems to me, is the right to be fully human, which is to be mean, depraved, ugly, nasty, obscure, intelligent, extraordinary, and original. And it seems to me that to try to find a capacious language which captures the full ambit and accords that full humanity to people who are not from the North and have carried the kinds of histories that they have in South Africa is a worthwhile project. And you can hear from what I'm saying that it's an intellectual project, and it's a political project. So that's my thinking around this topic at this time. Thank you.
Ashil, do you want to add anything? Not to that.
No, because entanglement is Sarah's concept, in fact. But okay. These are things.
I just have one last thing I'd like to ask you to speak to, and then I'll hand over to Rita. Ashil has recently set up a new institution in Johannesburg called the Johannesburg Workshop in Theory and Criticism, and it has associated with it a Johannesburg book salon. You write about this institution on the website as being an experiment in global conversation from the South. And that idea runs through a lot of the work that you've done. But I'd really like you to switch to something far less intellectual at this point and tell us a little about this institution and what its objectives are and how you hope to achieve that.
The Johannesburg Workshop in Theory and Criticism is a platform, aim of which, as Lindsay said, is to foster a conversation that is a global conversation in its nature, in its themes, and its participants, but from the global south, which is a way of taking seriously the place where one lives. And how, as Sarah was saying, how does one inhabits it? And part of the reasons why myself and a number of other friends, we set up this platform is to take seriously the opportunities that are opened up by the new regimes of circulation we live in. Of course, not everybody can move around. Of course, struggles to move tend today to become very, very serious global struggles, if only we take into account all the obstacles that are put into people moving throughout the world. But overall, we intellectual scholars, we seem to belong to a privileged class of people who can still relatively move around. So if we live, therefore, in a new regime of circulation, then the old division between center and periphery is not entirely abolished, but there are new ways in which it can be recalibrated, redirected in the benefit of people who have chosen to not be located in the West. And by the way, it's a good thing that not all of us are here. Now, I'm not talking to my dear friends Rita and Lindsay, but it's good that some of us keep holding fort over there. But it's even better if we can go back and forth. And the platform is an attempt to imagine what kind of thing it would take to facilitate that going back and forth. That in fact we belong to so many different localities today, and we have to harness the intellectual potentialities embedded in each of them if we want to account in a plausible manner of the complexity of the world we live in and its transformations. So it's a way, therefore, to imagine not really an institutional response, but a creative response to the dissented nature of our world in an intellectual level. So what is it that we do? We organize every year a major 10-day long seminar. The last one, and there are some here who participated in it, was organized around the theme, Rethinking the Political Under Late Capitalism. The theme had been chosen well before the financial crisis. But when the financial crisis occurred, it just gave more weight to the topicality of the theme. So we do that. We do have a blog. It is we use these new digital technologies for that. And we have a Salon, which is a digital magazine, the first issue of which will be put online, go live before the end of this month. So that's an attempt, indeed, at creating in Johannesburg, besides formal institutions, a space of hospitality where we can, instead of us coming here all the time, we can tell you, come and visit us, and let's talk, and this is what we put out as a theme of a conversation. And let me tell you, the last experience was highly successful, if we have to judge from the responses given by those who participated in it.
Thanks, Ashil. we'll be lining up to come and join you down there next year.
Rita, and for those of you who like soccer,
yes,
South Africa is organizing.
Yeah, you do two things at once.
2010.
Well, this is a very improvisational event, so I have to respond. I didn't know what I would be responding to, but I'm so grateful that you ended on with the idea of hospitality, because I think that Sarah and Ashiel have been so important to me in my life, because I was here in grad school, and I was very poor. You know, my 7 years in grad school and then my 7 years on the tenure track. And I started to have a feeling of myself as an exile. And, you know, there's something really sort of national and provincial almost about thinking of yourself as an exile, right? I think if we think of the world in these more hospitable and mobile ways, we're no longer exiles or locals or nationals. We all become migrants of some sort, and we are all, as Neville Hoad puts it in his wonderful book, we are all makwere kwere somewhere, but we are all at home somewhere. And I really do want to thank Sarah and Ashiel for making a kind of mobile home for myself. And I think it's also a tribute to their work that so many people from so many disciplines are here in the audience. This is something that I love about Penn, is you have an event, you never know who's going to show up, and then the right people come. I look across this room and I see colleagues from English, see colleagues from music, see colleagues from African studies, I see my NYU cohort, I'm sure I see Michelle from Romance Languages, so this is just really another sign of the mobile hospitality that I think you create. I thought that I wouldn't ask further questions, because after I speak, we want to open up to you all. And so I was desperately sitting here thinking what I would say that would be that would have the character of a summary, but also still open things up. So I thought to perhaps first tell you which phrases that Sarah and Ashiel invented at various points in their fertile careers, which were particularly useful to me, and that I've often quoted. And so now I think all of us will be using as entanglements, as Sarah Nuttall says. We'll all be quoting you on that lovely word. But for me, the first phrase that I always that I actually use in the introduction to my own book was a phrase that Ashiel used back in the day of the aesthetics of vulgarity, when you had to respond to all the many critics that went after you or supported you. You used the phrase, writing across a rift. And that phrase I just found so helpful to me personally, because I was thinking, yes, I have been writing across a rift. And it's both enabling, I mean, it's disabling to be sure, it's a rift, but it's also enabling. And I always like the rift, to me also sounds so African, you know, right? Writing across the rift. Another phrase that you all have used that I have also quoted, in fact, I quoted it in my statements on my research when I came up for full professor, the politics of hope. Today you use the phrase, the politics of possibility. And I just really want to say how much I value that. I think Sarah's emphasis on the idea of temporality is crucial. Ashiel reminds us constantly that he is a historian. But we're talking here about scholarship that has an eye to the future. And that is also its mobility and an aspect of its hospitality. And then another phrase that I always quote is from Sarah's wonderful essay on cities, writing the now. What does it mean to write the now? You know, the present is always the most elusive moment, right? Or if we think of the residual, the dominant, and the emergent, nobody knows what the emergent is. And we really often don't even know what the dominant is. So what does it mean to write the now? And I think this is what you've been trying to do in this work on Johannesburg and in other projects that you've taken on. But I always want to add to that, and I don't think it will surprise you, I want to add writing the now and the here, right? they're probably almost the same thing, right? But your point that you made about, where do we draw the boundary of Johannesburg? In Kinshasa? In Philadelphia? In London? Where is the here? I think that is one of the challenges of writing about globalization, whatever that might be, and about writing about the city. What constitutes the here? I also wanted to sort of add to this summary, response, whatever. Just again, my thoughts on some of the binary terms that I think Sarah and Ashiel use with such finesse, perhaps not to deconstruct in the strict sense, but to complicate, to tease out, to enrich. Some of them they've already spoken about today, but I would certainly include the relationship between profit and waste. The relationship between the surface and the underground, the relationship between center and periphery, the relationship between formal and informal, and, of course, the relationship between here and elsewhere. Finally, I think I'd just like to say what I think this work on the elusive metropolis, perhaps not so much elusive as open, enables us to do. I think that your work has been just wonderfully productive in its openness, first of all, to the literary. I think both of you, Sarah is a literary scholar in her origins, but I think Ashiel's work is always extraordinary literary. It's no wonder that we are here from Romance languages and English and so on. I think your work is characterized by its openness to the visual in the broadest sense. I'm not surprised that you've recently been working with Kentridge, with Marlene Dumas. Crucial to the, part of the visual would be certainly the commodity, the politics of style, that kind of surface, that kind of visuality. Another thing that strikes me, if I look at the full corpus of work that you have done that's been so generative, your openness to the biographical and to the autobiographical. I think that might be a way of actually perhaps thinking historically in a way that's not ensnared in that kind of, should we call it the Marxist Freudian politics of the uncanny, right? It is a way of thinking about trajectories, again, about movements. When Sarah and I organized a conference at WITS in, was it April of two years ago? Years ago, passed so quickly. we insisted that everybody who participated give a little, not so much a biography, an intellectual biography, but a kind of intellectual trajectory. And that was actually, in the end, one of the most helpful aspects of the conference, in that we knew where each person was coming from as a very real physical space, but also as a kind of intellectual space. And so I think it prevented us from feeling like there was any kind of script, right, any kind of political correctness to our inquiries. And it doesn't surprise me, therefore, that you guys have been involved in the project of what they call South African writing on and over the edge in At Risk and in Load Shedding, these collections of personal narratives about contemporary South Africa. I think that is a way of beginning to map the surfaces of our lives, their individuality and then their entanglements. I wanted perhaps to, and since I see some of my excellent friends and colleagues from the music department, we're here at SLOUT, which tends to be visual and theoretical. We have visual images here behind us. But I know that Ashiel is a musician, and I know that you're interested in music as well. I think that your work perhaps should... I think it's open to the musical, but perhaps we can ask you to say a little bit more about how music enables us to map these global trajectories of ours. I think people like Carol and Roger and Gavin would like to hear you on that. But I think I'll leave you with that so that there's you can respond briefly if you like. But really, this was by way of kind of improvised summary and a transition to the next part of our proceedings, which is to invite questions from all of you. I'll sort of field the questions when you
Thank
ask.
You, Rita.
So Sarah Nash,
do you want to talk to the music question?
Well, I mean, I just so much enjoyed what Rita was saying. I'm not sure that it calls for response. Okay. I think that she's been talking with and to my work and mine, me to hers for a long time. So, you know, I'm happy to just open it up.
Sure. Yeah. Questions from the floor? Tsitsi?
I mean, I'd like to comment, but I think it would be interesting to hear from Achille, first of all, about being a Cameroonian who's lived in Johannesburg for 89 years. And perhaps in the context of 2008, which was completely devastating for all of us when the xenophobic attacks took place in Johannesburg, it was a moment when we suddenly realized that we had to start a completely different kind of conversation about citizenship than the conversation we had been happily having more or less since 1994. So the terms of what was happening to the stranger in our midst was a conversation that we had to begin. But I would really think that Achille should speak before I do on this particular topic.
But, I mean, look, I don't know to what extent I'm still a Cameroonian. Clearly, I'm a Cameroonian when the national soccer team is on the field. And absolutely. I just go irrational. But I guess that's the only moment when... when I really claim, you know, to have been born somewhere. And to listen then to the call for autochthony. But I have spent my life moving from one place to the other. South Africa, more than, that's what I think, maybe more than any other country in the continent, has been constituted historically as, I would say, a transnational nation. It is a transnational nation well before the Dutch arrived in the Cape of Good Hope in the 17th century. It is because if you go back to the pre-colonial history of Southern Africa, it is fundamentally a history of movement, mobility, migration. That the history of making, remaking, and making of polities, which take so many different forms, chiefdoms, kingdoms, and so forth and so on. But we have a hard time taking into consideration or taking seriously that history of permanent, constant openness, to use a term Rita just gave us a moment ago. So it's a place where almost everybody comes from somewhere else. But that origination from somewhere else, in the context of the history of nation states, has not always been taken seriously, because the nation state wouldn't be the nation state if it didn't discriminate between citizens and non-citizens. And in spite of all what is going on, process of globalization, as long as the nation state is the power that adjudicates on who is citizen and who is a stranger, the nation state will remain a resilient form. As long as it monopolizes that power, which is the other side of the power to decide on who can move and who is to stay where he or she is. So it seems to me that part of what is going on in South Africa is that In the post-apartheid period, which, by the way, is concomitant with the period of globalization on the one hand and hyper-liberalization on the other, that liberation happens simultaneously with liberalization. And that concomitance of these two processes creates a whole set of problems in terms of who is a citizen and who is not. In a context in which the South African Constitution provides a whole set of rights to citizens, and not at all to non-citizens. So it seems to me that there is a deep political cultural question here. How is it that this place can assume, reinvent itself and its identity, not necessarily as a nation state, but as an Afropolitan nation, meaning a nation, the identity of which is premised on an embrace, proud embrace of the world and of its elsewheres. But maybe it's asking too much, since elsewhere in the world we are witnessing, in fact, a contraction of the cosmopolitan possibilities some thought had been opened up by the fall of the Berlin Wall and the process of economic globalization. So, to that extent, South Africa is just being a normal, banal country, where, of course, I mean, not that everybody kills the foreigners, but it might happen.
Okay, I just want to intervene for a second, because there's such a wonderful cartoon that I saw that does suggest that perhaps there's something different here with xenophobia in South Africa. It is a cartoon of a man sitting on a bench, tired. He has a giant club next to him. He's resting from beating people up. And on the bench, it says, "Whites only." And that is scored through, and it says, "South Africans only." And I think that's, you know, it may be that we're ordinary in our xenophobia, but there's something, I think, also in the history that makes it particularly, particularly sad.
Yeah, there's a melancholy. I mean, when this happened, was it last year? It was a very low moment for the country. It happened at the same time as the so-called load sheddings. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure that these common phenomenon elsewhere, where you try to give names, funny, nice names to things which are really horrific. I was telling Sarah and Lindsay that when I grew up in Cameroon, we lived under a one-party state, and there was a center where they tortured political opponents. And the center was called Center for Study and Documentation. So something really very academic. But I'm sure if you do the study, I mean, what was happening in the Soviet Union, you will find the same kinds of names. So load shedding is, I mean, what is it? It's that you are reading in your living room, and then power goes off, and you have no idea when it will come back.
I mean, the load shedding thing was really interesting because it was a sort of an interesting psychic and political shift. I mean, Achille would just lose it, you know, if the lights went out, because it reminded him the memory of Dakar, of West Africa, Sundays with no power and no lights. Mm-hmm. You know, what's the problem with Africa, he kind of would say. People have been working in Angola and Mozambique just kind of laughing at us, saying, "What is wrong with losing the power once a week? Do you know what it's like elsewhere?" And then losing the power once a week, but looking on the internet, right? This is typical Johannesburg, to see when your power is going to be off, 6:30 to 10:30. Oh, thanks a lot. Okay. All right. So at least you could plan for sitting in the dark. I think that there's a way in which politically and psychologically you then start connecting yourself to other cities in the African continent by thinking through, well, what did they do? How was it for them, etc.? So an interesting moment of an insertion into a particular kind of Africanness. I would love to have the time to answer your question in another way, which is, I think intellectually and in terms of sort of critical theory, we are in conversation with Lagos, Kinshasa, and Nairobi in all sorts of ways. And it's emerging that there is a Nairobi School of Gaudama Studies or a Few God Studies. And in fact, these texts that we have taught for so long as quintessentially South African texts have the histories of other cities and other readings embedded in them. So one of the most interesting things, the work that we can do now, I think, is within and between African cities, but to turn that into a theoretical space, not just a space dominated by NGOs and the language of policy. So I'm hoping we can do that. I mean, in some ways, I think that what one would be wanting to be doing is to be speaking for people like us who do move back and forth and are making these complex assessments about how to navigate that. You know, but it seems to me also that there is a generation of either ex-South African critics or people who have not been there for a long time who do hold forth about the place in all sorts of ways. So there are a number of agendas going on. I would be speaking for somebody like you and like myself who wishes to move between places. Could I just say about the frontier, I think that it's true that Johannesburg has thought of itself, South Africa in many ways, has been critically and theoretically navigated via a notion of the frontier for reasons you will know and understand, and that continues into the present, partly, for instance, sometimes it feels in Johannesburg these days that there's another gold rush going on. There's a tremendous amount of wealth in the city alongside a tremendous amount of poverty, and that people are chasing that wealth really hard. So the kind of frontier politics of the gold mines are repeating themselves in some ways as the new middle class makes itself felt. But I think that what we're dealing with is an incredibly rough public space. We're dealing with a rough public space where the political lines are brutally drawn. But what we are... It's precisely that frontier mentality that I think many of us are trying to renegotiate and to take up the true challenge of our generation, which I think was presented in 1994, but to say, well, how can we build a public space and an intellectual space based around trust and vulnerability, for instance, rather than through political masquerading and so on. In terms of what you were saying about the kind of hidden histories that are that inhabit South Africa, probably for me that's the most compelling reason to be thinking and working from there, and that the histories of entanglement are one of those hidden histories. A book came out recently, for instance, about the cross-racial marriage between a white woman and a Chinese man in Johannesburg in the late 19th century. And the kinds of histories and what happens to those people and how they navigate the city are all over the place, but simply haven't been written about. So it does seem to me that we are sitting on the edge of a very interesting critical moment in terms of navigating a city which has borne witness to the history of segregation and the fact that wherever you build boundaries, the more you build boundaries, the more people are going to transgress them, and what you do with that history too. It's a hidden history.
Yeah. Ashil, I think, do you want to respond to any of that?
No? Okay. Nope.
No, I just want to recognize that our city has a bad reputation, and we're struggling against that. But I was reading recently a very interesting piece written by a Colombian anthropologist who studied at Yale and then came to work in Johannesburg. He's from Bogota. And he wrote this really interesting piece about crime in Bogota and crime in Johannesburg, in which he makes you want to live in Johannesburg rather than in Bogota, but that's that doesn't resolve the question of crime as such. It just renders it a bit more, you know, negative comparison. But I think it goes further than that. I mean, these are things we talk about all the time. And these are things which can be documented sociologically. And they're also part of the experience of living there on an everyday basis. In my own piece in Load Shedding, I write about the fact that, I mean, I go back into narratives of dreams I have at night during the period of load shedding, or 8 months. And I dutifully wrote them down. And what was striking was the fact that most of those dreams had something to do with fear. And as far as I remember, I'm not somebody who is easily frightened. Or when I was growing up, I would be frightened by the darkness of the night and the stories of ghosts and things like that. But never frightened at the idea that I might be living in my own house and be killed by somebody I don't know of. I have no problem with that person, and that person might even get away without... he might never be caught, or if he's caught, he might never go to jail. If he goes to jail, so how is it that one negotiates those personal, deep personal experiences in a city that is still, for many, a city of possibility? A city of possibility, meaning that for most South Africans and other Africans and people who come to Johannesburg, the future is still somewhat opened, in spite of huge amounts of poverty and deprivation. And how is it that in our critical, theoretical, political work, we take into consideration these cul-de-sacs, and at the same time, the reservoirs of futurity we continue to live with? Home that we can build here, a place, I mean, where we feel at home, that we inhabit as ours. So that double prong, a critique that is deconstructionist, but also a critique that is about proposing, it seems to me is something we experience with acuity when thinking from there.
Thank you. I think we're going to draw it to a close. There are still more questions.
We can deal with it after.
I was asked to draw things to a close, so if you don't mind addressing your questions to Ashil and Sarah afterwards. I'd like to thank you all for being here, and to thank Aaron, to thank Rita.